Hello and welcome to Volume 43, Number 44 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 3rd of November 2023. Hi, I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by your newsreader Andrew. And in this week's issue, the JPUH declares a critical incident, a local winner of a top hotels award, and why is the tap water turning green? In addition, a timely piece from Margaret Too from our online time in 2020, and Andrew on the worst Halloween and the Guy Fawkes debacle. Yes, all the details on your local news and events during the next hour, but first, it's the birthdays. Well, we have two people to send best wishes to this week, and both for the same day, that day being next Monday, November the 6th. Yes, Jane Wright and Lisa Smith will be blowing out the candles, and everyone here at Grapevine hopes that you both have a wonderful day. Okay, time for some news, so it's over to Andrew.
Hello everyone, Andrew here with you for another week on Grapevine. Well, I hope you're all warm and dry now, after yet another spell of somewhat damp and breezy weather. I can't guarantee sunshine all the way, but actually, as I'm recording this and I look out of the window, there's the most beautiful double rainbow in the sky. But as always at Grapevine, we'll try and bring you the best of stories and features from around your area. Okay. On with the news. Warnings were issued last Wednesday as Norfolk was bracing itself for Storm Ciarán, with council bosses making special preparations as the county faced a battering from heavy rain and winds of up to 50 miles an hour. Leaders at Norfolk County Council urged people to avoid travelling during the storm, which was due to sweep over parts of the county from Wednesday night, November the 1st. Amid fears of flooding and fallen trees, the council was bolstering the number of tree surgeons and drainage teams ready to deal with the effects of the latest storm to sweep the county. With this latest storm due just weeks after Storm Babette left the roads impassable, County Hall's highway team was taking steps to prevent new delays and disruption to traffic. The county council bolstered its out-of-hours service to bring in extra tree surgeons, drainage contractors and tankers. Maintenance teams were on standby at the authorities' depots to deal with fallen trees and flooding. And the council said it had scouted the roads it is responsible for, which does not include the A47 or the A11, to identify issues. Sites known to be particularly susceptible to flooding were also being carefully monitored. Graham Plant, the council's cabinet member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport, said last Wednesday, "We know Storm Ciarán is coming, and that the winds and rain can have a real impact on transport across Norfolk. The simple advice is the best, and I'd urge anyone who can avoid travelling during the storm to do so. If you do have to travel, check the situation on the roads before you leave, plan your journey accordingly, and don't take risks. Don't drive through floodwater, and always drive in a safe way suitable to the road conditions." A Met Office yellow weather warning for wind was in place from 9 p.m. on Wednesday, November the 1st, until midnight on Thursday, November the 2nd. Forecasters warned winds could reach up to 50 or 60 miles an hour in more exposed coastal areas of Norfolk, and up to 40 miles an hour further inland. Thursday was also forecast to see heavy rainfall. Last week, the Norfolk Broads were on high alert for flooding, with extremely high water levels reported, officials have warned. Paul Rice, a senior flood warden for the waterways in the area, said the area was now braced for the impact of Storm Ciarán, which was due to arrive within 24 hours of his comments. He said water levels had been extremely high in recent weeks, particularly in the aftermath of Storm Babette. In some areas, the water has risen over the bank, with waterside car parks flooded. His team, with help from the Environment Agency, has installed flood barriers at vulnerable locations. Mr. Rice said, "We started sandbagging 10 days ago in preparation for the adverse weather. This is almost as bad as 2019, which actually flooded Potter Heigham." A barn was set on fire during broad daylight attack in West Caister. Police and fire services were called to the building off the A149 Caister bypass just after 2 p.m. on Saturday, October the 28th. Nobody was injured, but a boat inside the barn was damaged and the incident is being treated as arson. Investigations are ongoing and police are asking that anyone who witnessed the incident or saw suspicious activity in the area at the time to call Norfolk Police on 101. Now, sad to report, but Fusion Hair Consultants in Goulston High Street closed for good on Saturday after 25 years of trading on Goulston's main commercial thoroughfare. Managing Director Kevin Huggins said the changing business landscape of hairdressing, accelerated by the COVID pandemic and rising utility costs, were among the reasons he and his wife Tanya decided to call it a day. "The lease was up on the shop and we were offered a renewal, but I'm in an age where I didn't really want to start a new one," said Mr. Huggins, who is 68. "Unfortunately, the hairdressing market has changed now. It's more about self-employment than it is about employing people. Over 2 decades, the salon has trained more than 100 people. But," Mr. Huggins said, "Fusion had lost 19 stylists during the pandemic, with many people opting to work for themselves. It gets to the stage where you train people up and they become your competitors," he added. "We've had 4 trainees on, but it's a big unit to fill and things were made more difficult by the rising cost of utilities, so we decided to call it a day." Tanya Huggins, who's a director also, will continue hairdressing and some training from home. Kevin, who has been working for 54 years, said he intends to retire, but with animals at home and golf to be played, he has got plenty of things to keep himself busy. He said he's sad to be leaving the high street, but will remain chair of the Goulston Traders Association. He added, "It's sad for the high street, but it's like the old saying, use it or lose it. I wouldn't let the Traders Association go, and the Christmas light switch on is something I'm still very passionate about." The closure of Fusion Hair Consultants comes as several national chains have recently left the commercial heart of the town, including Barclays and Wilko. The James Paget Hospital moved to critical incident level 2 status at 5 p.m. on Monday, October the 30th, following high demand at the emergency department and intense pressure on bed capacity. The stress on the hospital comes days after Great Yarmouth was named the UK's current COVID hotspot, with more cases per head than any other area in England and Wales. A critical incident means the local NHS is facing extraordinary pressure and cannot function as normal. A spokesperson for the James Paget said, "We are currently experiencing high demand at our hospital and, as such, would remind people to only attend accident and emergency if it is a genuine emergency. Patients with appointments or procedures at the hospital have been advised to attend as planned." An email sent to hospital staff on Monday, October the 30th, said the operational situation at the JPH had become more pressured and they were moving from Opal 4 to critical incident level status 2. "We are facing high demand in our emergency department with long delays in patient handovers from our ambulance service colleagues," the email said. "At the same time, our bed capacity is also under intense pressure and we are using our escalation areas. As such, it is essential that our full focus is on alleviating our current operational situation both tonight and tomorrow. So please continue to cancel all non-essential meetings," the email added. Alex Stewart, Chief Executive of Healthwatch Norfolk, said, "Critical incidents are only declared when absolutely necessary, and we understand the reasons for the hospital making the decision. This means some appointments and procedures will need to be cancelled during the duration of that incident. We would urge that these patients at the James Paget Hospital are contacted in a timely way, and that options for further care and appointments are explained clearly to them," he added. People needing urgent medical care, which is not an emergency, have been asked to visit NHS 111 online or call NHS 111 for advice on how to get care at any time of day or night. For non-urgent cases, speak to your GP practice or a pharmacist. The hospital said it is working closely with our partners in the Norfolk and Waveney healthcare system to maximise capacity during this period of high demand. Brandon Lewis, MP for Great Yarmouth, said, "I visited the James Paget today and the large number of patients being seen was obvious. I would like to pay tribute to the staff who are working hard under difficult conditions." A man is described feeling defenceless as he was allegedly raped and sexually assaulted by another man he gave a lift home to almost 20 years ago. The man, who cannot be identified for legal reasons, was a teenager when he gave Sean Gilder, then in his 20s, a lift home from a barbecue in Blunderston, Suffolk. Norwich Crown Court has heard the car being driven by the alleged victim pulled onto an estate being built in Galston near the James Paget Hospital in the early hours of May the 22nd, 2004, so Gilder, who was drunk, could be sick. Gilder, aged 40, formerly of Norwich but now of Chestnut Avenue, Alton Broad, has gone on trial having denied two counts of rape and one of assault against the victim after they pulled over. Giving evidence on Tuesday, October 31st, the victim said he was defenceless against Gilder, who, quote, "began to force himself onto me and pinned him against the car." The jury of eight women and four men heard a police interview with the victim in 2018 in which he said, "I told him I didn't want this, but he wouldn't take no for an answer. He said, I shouted, I screamed, I told him to get off me." After being raped, the victim said he was then sexually assaulted by Gilder and tried to resist. He said he was then dragged into the back of a car before being raped for a second time. Jurors heard the victim first went to police in September 2004, but did not pursue the prosecution at the time due to the state of his own health, as he had not come out to everyone, including his grandparents. In a second interview given to police in 2021, he said what happened had stuck with me for a long, long time and was still with me to this day. He said it screwed me up. The trial continues. A bid to build a roof extension has been rejected, with planners calling the proposal jarring and uncomfortable. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has refused a planning application to remove a roof and replace it with a higher pitch and raised eaves to form accommodation at a house on Station Road South in Belton. The proposal would have seen the roof height increase from 7.9 metres to 10.4 metres. There were no objections to the bid, but planners said the taller roof would appear jarring and uncomfortable. The scale, form and appearance of the two-storey rear extension was, quote, "too large and incongruous when compared to the character of the original dwelling and the surrounding street scene." Officials also said there would be adverse impacts on a neighbouring house. Residents of that neighbouring dwelling would experience an increased sense of overbearing development and a reduction in outlook, especially from their front amenity space and their front rooms, they stated. The house was built before 1913 and originally formed part of a small hamlet to the east of the former railway line and Belton railway station. And officials could launch a review of the licence of a Norfolk Broads pub following a series of complaints over raves at the controversial venue. The Beecham Arms, which sits on the banks of the River Yare, could have its alcohol licence revoked after a series of objections were made to police and South Norfolk Council, the SNC. One noise complaint came from a boat moored at Coldham Hall, some 2.5 miles away. Others were over a wide area of the Yare Valley, from Rockland St Mary to Hassingham. The revelation that the pub was facing review was made at an SNC licensing committee meeting on Tuesday. The meeting was being held to discuss a request for a temporary license to host a late night rave at the pub in February 2024. A council official said a review was something they were almost definitely considering, but was unable to elaborate further. Plans for the late night license, called a temporary event notice, were rejected by the committee. While the pub is owned by Raymond Hollocks, the application for the temporary licence was submitted by Callum Richardson, the host of the event. A previous party in July attracted some 400 revellers and 32 DJs. Ali Pridmore, an environmental protection officer at SNC, had gone along to monitor the event, accompanied by police officers, because previous ones had attracted complaints. Mr. Pridmore told the meeting that he had found Mr. Hollocks had been dismissive and challenging. Mr. Hollocks, who was not at the committee meeting, had in turn accused the official of being rude and aggressive, and had made a complaint against him. Mr. Pridmore said body-worn camera footage reviewed by the police showed that was not the case. The committee heard the pub sits in a low-lying flat area, and various conditions such as wind direction could lead sound to carry a considerable distance. Mr. Hollocks has been involved in a number of disputes with the local council, as well as the Broads Authority over the Beecham Arms and his other broad sites at Burney Arms and the Loddon Marina. He and his son William Hollocks are being prosecuted by the Broads Authority over a long-running saga involving caravans on the site of the Beecham Arms. Both have denied a charge of failing to comply with enforcement notices served by the authority at Norwich Magistrates Court. The notice relates to the storing of two static caravans on the land and the use of them for residential purposes, and the case is set to return to court in the future. Now, an advertised upcoming fireworks event in Great Yarmouth is believed to be a scam. A Facebook page called Sparkfest Great Yarmouth has been promoting a public fireworks event at the Beaconsfield Recreation Ground on Saturday, November the 4th, from 5:30 p.m. Tickets have been available for the event on the website RSVPify, with adult general admission costing £5 and child general admission at £2. There is also a Yapsody website where tickets can be purchased. A Great Yarmouth Borough Council spokesperson said, "Great Yarmouth Borough Council has not received an event notification or a request for permission to hold an event under this name on council land." On November the 1st, the Sparkfest Facebook page posted images of a fun fair being installed in a grassy area, with a message reading, and this is in capital letters, "Welcome to the House of Fun. The fun fair is starting to take shape and we are so excited." However, an Eastern Counties newspaper's reporter visited Beaconsfield Recreation Ground on the morning of November the 1st and nothing had been set up. Great Yarmouth Borough Council commented on the Sparkfest post, "We believe this is a scam as we have not given permission for this event on our land." Posts from a Facebook page titled Sparkfest Great Yarmouth have promoted an event at the park featuring a fireworks display, theme park rides, food, and from the Stratford-upon-Avon Company takeaway, the Lazy Pig Co., and another takeaway called Gyros Express. A member of the Lazy Pigs Facebook team has commented on posts made by Sparkfest that they will not be attending and they believe the event is a scam. Posts from the scam Facebook page have been sent to various local groups. It is believed the scam account has been operating for the past year, posing as different events across the country, including a Christmas Festival of Light in Cosham, Portsmouth, and an Enchanted Forest event in Braintree, Essex, both in November 2022. Norfolk Trading Standards and Norfolk Constabulary have been contacted.
Thanks, Andrew. More news in just a while. But first, you may wonder at the end of this recording why there wasn't more about the recent storm. Well, this is down to the necessary schedule we have to get Grapevine to you each week, with our cut-off point for news from the Mercury being Thursday afternoon. Now, normally this is not an issue, but there will be stories about the consequences of the storm appearing on Friday. Fear not, however, as these will be covered in next week's issue. OK, from our online-only time in November 2020, here's a piece from Margaret Two, as we call her, where she remembers her childhood fireworks events.
Well, hello again, everybody. And this time I'd like to share with you some of my memories of Bonfire Night. Yes, Bonfire Night. That's what we always called it. Not Guy Fawkes. Of course, we knew the story behind it, the gunpowder plot, which was meant to blow up the Houses of Parliament. And we all knew the little rhyme, which went something like this. Remember, remember the 5th of November. Gunpowder, treason and plot. I see no reason why gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. But I'm not sure that we ever really connected with it. I certainly didn't. However, and as the autumn drew on and the nights grew darker, the thought of bonfire night and fireworks became more and more exciting. And when we were children in the 40s and 50s, there was no mention of Halloween and certainly no tricking or treating. I doubt if most of us had even heard of it. All that seems to have come much later, probably from America. But of course, a good while before the night itself, there was the serious business of saving up for fireworks. Loving mums and dads and grandparents always contributed, but it was all the more fun if you'd actually made the effort to save up a bit of pocket money to pay for some of the fireworks yourself. And in those lean post-war years, we understood the need for it, and it was good training. I don't think the shopkeepers were supposed to sell them before a certain date, and we could hardly wait until the day came when we could actually go shopping for our fireworks. They would all be displayed enticingly and safely under glass, and it was a source of both agony and enjoyment to choose what to have. They came in all sorts and sizes, from sparklers, golden and silver rains, Roman candles, which were inclined to spit and had to be treated with great respect, Catherine wheels and rockets, which were supposed to be placed in bottles, right through to the big ones, which seemed to us to be really grand and exotic. Now, one year, I had a special firework, which was very special, and it was called a Sahara Sun. Actually, my grandfather bought it in Petticoat Lane in London when his boat was laying near the Tower of London, and because of that, I was persuaded without too much difficulty that the King had sent it especially for me, together with two big pine cones, which was I had to save until December for Father Christmas's reindeers. Anyway, after my two older cousins had carried the fireworks home for me, they were stowed away safely in biscuit tins and put somewhere out of my reach, although I was often allowed to take them out and look at them. Actually, the very first bonfire night that I remember was one that I didn't actually take part in, not directly anyway. Of course, it was November the 5th, which meant nothing to me then, as I was about 4 years old, and it would have been one of the first times that a bonfire night could be celebrated after the blackouts of World War II. And it was a day of unimaginable bliss, as my adored grandfather, who was home from sea, took me from Galston to Winterton to be shown to my great-grandmother, who had been bombed out and was living with relatives. To begin with, there was the great excitement of going for the first time on a red bus. At that time, all the buses I knew about were blue. Don't small things impress little children? But the journey home in the dark of the early evening on bonfire night was like a drive through fairyland. The whole countryside was ablaze with bonfires. It was enchanting. And most memorable of all was the biggest bonfire. It looked to me like a haystack on fire, and I was told later on that it was on Ormsby Green. I've never forgotten that wonderful night, and in later years we sometimes spoke about it. And after all this time, it is to me one of my most treasured memories. Now, when we were a bit older, it was always a joy if bonfire night fell on a Friday or Saturday. No school the next day, so we could stay up a bit later. Needless to say, if it fell on a Sunday, there would not be a fire or a firework to be seen or heard. It was always celebrated on the Saturday instead. And yes, I know that fireworks can be very dangerous. Although, thank goodness, I never remember any accidents among the children where I lived, but I'm sure they did happen. And I know that all the noise and flashes are terrifying to animals. But at least in those days, it was all confined to just one night. And so once it was over, pet owners have no more need to worry. Not so nowadays. But once tea was over and darkness fell, then it was time for the fun to begin. And in the cul-de-sac where we lived, it was an understood thing that we all went round to each other's houses. There was no set pattern to it, it just seemed to happen. And it didn't seem to matter too much if there were no actual bonfires. We didn't all have them. It was the fireworks that were the main attraction. And mine were lit in my grandparents' back garden. Mum and Dad would arrive in good time. And one year, my big brother Douglas, who was on leave from the Navy, turned up, much to my delight, complete with bell-bottom trousers and a box of fireworks labelled "From the Hong Kong Cracker Jack Factory." Blue touch paper was lit, always by the grown-ups, of course. Rockets were sent soaring up into the sky, and Catherine wheels were pinned to the trellis. Wonderful colours, wonderful flashes of light. And when at last that part of the evening was all over, away we children went to the other gardens, us little ones safely in the care of the older ones. However, I do remember one occasion which I never told my parents about. One of the boys in our gang, not much older than I was, had parents who were much more relaxed about safety than mine were, and they let us loose in their big garden with fireworks and a box of matches and left us to get on with it. It was all great fun, and thankfully no harm was done, but I was a bit disconcerted when a banger, which I think was called a jumping jack, chased me down the garden path with much noise and smoke.
I hated that.
This was a new experience, as I never had bangers, so I was caught on the hop, literally. Fortunately then, the big boys arrived, and they were having a huge bonfire on the waste ground, which we call the field. So I retreated, thankfully, with a couple of others, to the safety of our end of the road. Now, oddly enough, I don't remember that we had many actual guys. I can only remember some years later, when I felt I was a bit too old to think about making guys, that some of the younger children did just that. Now, this guy was a real work of art, and for some reason a cigarette was stuck in his mouth. He was carried around on an old wooden kitchen chair to be admired by all the neighbours, and being tall, I was roped in to help carry him. But, of course, as we've said before, nothing stays the same, and in time, the big organised displays took the place of fun in the garden, and more people had the cars to get to the displays. It was probably a good thing in many ways, and certainly much safer. But I do remember that the very first one, which took place on one of the country estates not far from us, caused a massive tailback on the main road, as dozens of cars converged on the only entrance to the lane which led to the area where it was all about to happen. And it was useless for people who lived nearby to protest that they'd been at work all day and just wanted to get home. They couldn't. They just had to sit it out and like it. Goodness knows what time the display finally took place. But at that time, in the 1970s, there were still families who liked to celebrate Bonfire Night in a traditional way. And where we lived, not far from where I had first grown up, there were several families and some older people with grandchildren. So as our back gardens converged, it was a joy to join in. And we always saved our garden rubbish to burn on Bonfire Night. In those days, nobody gave much thought to the environment, so we had the fires. And just as we had done in the previous generation, the children around us had a lovely time. One year, just for fun, I bought a packet of sparklers and lit them by what was probably our last bonfire. After making sure that our cat was safely indoors with a comforting saucer of milk and plenty of fuss from Mum, who was his devoted servant. So we'll leave that with the happy days. Thank you again for listening, and please do stay safe.
Come closer and cuddle me tight. My heart goes boom, bang, a bang, boom, bang, a bang when you are near. Boom, bang, a bang, boom, bang, a bang loud in my ear. Pounding away, won't you be mine? Boom, bang, a bang, bang all the time. It's such a lovely feeling when I'm in your
tenuously appropriate via the title of Boom Bang A Bang, but it was the Eurovision Song Contest winner in 1969 from Lulu. Surprisingly, there's not a lot of songs about fireworks, and we don't have time for the fireworks suite. Right, back to Andrew with some more news, followed very closely by a gruesome Halloween tale and The Man Behind Bonfire Night.
A retail unit in Hemsby that has been used as a takeaway has been put on the rental market. The kiosk, which previously traded as Nawab Indian Takeaway on Beach Road in Hemsby, is being advertised by Bycroft Commercial Estate Agents. The lease on the property is available for an annual rent of £15,000. The premises has a customer-facing reception at the front with preparation areas to the rear. Now, this story has been on the main news as well. And MPs across Norfolk have reacted to the government's U-turn on the mass closure of railway station ticket offices. On Tuesday, Transport Secretary Mark Harper revealed Number 10 had asked train operators to withdraw their proposals following an extensive consultation period. Ticket offices at Great Yarmouth, King's Lynn, Thetford, Downham Market and Diss had been earmarked for closure by industry body the Rail Delivery Group, the RDG. The facilities in Norwich would have become a customer information centre, with Greater Anglia previously saying it would, quote, offer a full range of products and provide help with more complex transactions. However, these proposals have now been axed in response to Watchdogs Transport Focus and London Travel Watch, which announced they opposed every single planned closure due to issues such as the impact on accessibility. Former Prime Minister and Conservative MP for South West Norfolk, Liz Truss, welcomed the decision. She said, when proposals were first mooted to close the ticket offices at Thetford and Downham Market, I urged Greater Anglia and Great Northern to rethink the move. My postbag has been inundated with letters from constituents worried about what this would mean for vulnerable passengers unable to buy tickets online or from machines. I'm glad the government appears to have understood the public mood on this issue in calling for the proposals to be shelved. Rail users will be reassured that they will still be able to purchase tickets and make inquiries about their travel at ticket offices. A rail company source told the PA news agency the U-turn had caused quiet fury in the industry. It comes as passenger numbers nationwide stand at their lowest since 2002 and revenue lies at 30% below pre-COVID levels. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said in September that closing ticket offices was the right thing for the British public and the British taxpayers because only 1 in 10 tickets are sold currently in ticket offices. Great Yarmouth MP Brandon Lewis also hailed the government's decision. "This is great news for the town and for rail passengers across the country," he said. "I shared the concerns of constituents who were rightly worried about these proposals, and when I responded formally to the consultation, I highlighted these concerns and the impact closure would have on an important gateway to the town. I'm now looking forward to the result of a government audit of all stations and their assessment of what changes can be made to benefit passengers. There is a fantastic opportunity following this decision. We can create a travel hub at the station to provide travel and visitor information whilst continuing to provide support to travellers who need it most." Labour's candidate for Great Yarmouth, Keir Cousins, added, "One of my first acts as Labour candidate for Great Yarmouth was to campaign against the closure of our ticket office. I'm pleased that the Conservatives have changed course thanks to the overwhelming local opposition to this move." Last week, the Cross-Party Transport Committee of MPs warned the plans went too far, too fast, and described the consultation process as lacking in transparency. Transport Focus's Chief Executive Andy Smith said there had been around 750,000 responses to the consultation. "This is the right decision that reflects my opposition to the planned closures, which I've set out to ministers on behalf of local passengers," said James Wilde, MP for North West Norfolk. "While many choose to buy online or at ticket machines, vulnerable people rely on the support provided by ticket office staff, and stopping the closure of Lynn Ticket Office is welcome news for them." In his announcement on Tuesday, Mr. Harper said the proposals did not, quote, "meet the high threshold set by ministers, and so the government has asked train operators to withdraw these proposals." Speaking on the announcement, Norwich North MP Chloe Smith said, "The government is right to demand the highest of standards in this. For Norwich, I sought clear reassurance from Greater Anglia for passengers, and we knew that station opening times, accessibility and facilities would not change, and they would add extra help on the concourse as well. I hope that Norwich passengers are reassured." Norwich South MP Clive Lewis, speaking on Tuesday's government announcement, said, "This is really great news. It was a very bad idea. Public services are public services and it shouldn't be at the bottom line which decides if it's needed. If they're needed, then we should have them." Mr. Lewis's party colleague, Alice MacDonald, who's hoping to win Norwich North in the next general election, added, "This Tory government U-turn is very welcome news for passengers and staff and should have happened much sooner." People in Great Yarmouth and Goulston have reported their tap water turning green in recent days. The tinge is most obvious in large volumes of water, such as when filling a bath. And officials believe that the tint is a consequence of recent heavy rainfall and insist the water is still safe to drink. A spokesman from Essex and Suffolk Water said, "We were made aware of reports of discoloured water from customers in the Great Yarmouth area. We have investigated and believe this may have been caused by a change in the raw water quality at Ormsby Treatment Works following the storms over the weekend. We would like to reassure customers that the change in the colour of the water is purely aesthetic only. This means that the water is absolutely safe to use and to drink and has been thoroughly treated to its usual high standard." Similar reports have emerged from homes in and around Norwich. Anglian Water, which supplies the Norwich area, also blamed heavy rainfall and insisted the water was safe. A blunder which has left Norfolk schools with £5.6 million less than they were expecting for the next academic year has sparked calls for the Education Secretary to intervene to correct the error. Great Yarmouth MP Sir Brandon Lewis and Norfolk County Council's Children's Services Cabinet Member Penny Carpenter have written to Gillian Keegan to ask for a meeting. The blunder, which has affected most schools across the country, happened because officials at the Department for Education miscalculated the amount of money to be distributed after a shake-up at one local authority. Union leaders warned that that could have a devastating effect on Norfolk schools, with the potential need for staff cuts and fewer school trips. In July, the government announced that the national funding formula allocations, the amount of money schools are given to provide education, would be increasing by 2.7%. However, that figure has been revised to 1.9%, which will see Norfolk losing out on about £5.6 million. County Councillor Mrs Carpenter had written to the Department for Education calling for the government to honour the original funding offer. But now, she and Sir Brandon have written to Mrs Keegan asking for an urgent meeting over the issue. Mrs Carpenter said, "Schools, pupils and parents shouldn't pay the price for this mistake in the Department of Education's calculations." They had already been working to the figures announced in July, and council staff have been supporting them to try to understand the impact of the reduced funding. "I believe the Department for Education should honour the funding announced in July. Otherwise, schools face difficult decisions around staffing levels." Sir Brandon said, "I'm concerned over the impact this could have on areas of higher deprivation, such as my constituency of Great Yarmouth, where we know education can make a significant difference to young people's prospects." But Mike Smith-Clair, education spokesman on the opposition Labour group at County Hall, said, "The government have clearly ignored the previous letter from the leader and Mrs Carpenter, who said if the Secretary of State didn't meet her demands for fairness, she would go to London to see her. Time she did, rather than waste her efforts on another hollow gesture." The Broads Authority warned on Wednesday that boaters' lives could be at risk if they tried to navigate the waters during Storm Ciarán. The Met Office had issued warnings for wet and windy weather for the east of England, with potential gusts of up to 60 miles per hour. Lucy Birchnall, head of Ranger Services at the Broads Authority, said boaters should not navigate the storm if possible, and to expect high water levels to remain long after the storm recedes. The authority warned that fast-flowing and deep floodwater could put lives at risk, and said areas with low bridges and moorings will be most difficult to pass through. The authority advised boaters to ensure their boats and covers were secure, and said those who do find themselves on the waters should be careful where they moor up, avoiding areas with lots of trees and other potentially unstable structures. They must make sure their ropes are properly adjusted when mooring, be cautious when steering in winds, and be extra careful getting on and off the boat. Broads Authority rangers had increased the number of safety checks around the Broads before the storm, and are undertaking additional checks following, particularly looking for any fallen trees or other obstructions. And staying with the storm, hundreds of homes along the coast were left without power on Thursday morning. Some people living in and around Hemsby woke up without power. UK Power Networks has said that 448 properties had no electricity due to Storm Ciarán. Engineers were quickly at the scene and working to fix the issue. A spokesman for the electricity supplier said on Thursday, "Engineers are now on site carrying out investigations into the fault. Once they have completed their assessment, they will carry out repairs." A Great Yarmouth-based fundraising committee is hanging up its collecting tins after 55 years and raising more than £1 million for a cancer charity. The Great Yarmouth Committee of Macmillan Cancer Support was originally formed in 1967, with the inaugural meeting being held at the Town Hall. The committee started off small with additional helpers from the local Lions Club, helping at events from time to time. Over the years, Macmillan presented service awards to committee members, including two members receiving the Richard Hambrough Award for long and outstanding service. The annual Macmillan Ball was the major fundraiser for many years, with approximately 350 people attending. Many other events were supported and organised over the years, including ladies' lunches, quizzes, cookery demonstrations, flower demonstrations and golf days. Many changes have occurred over the years, resulting in the group becoming larger and officers changing. It is believed the committee raised more than £1.3 million by the end of 2022. In addition, the Lowestoft Committee, who had raised a further £300,000, joined with Great Yarmouth, bringing the grand total to £1.6 million. Michelle Hutchinson, National Senior Fundraising Manager at Macmillan Cancer Support, said, "We have been so lucky to have such a dedicated and successful fundraising committee in this area for all of this time. The committee members should be so proud of their achievements and the impact that their fundraising has had. I want to thank every committee member and volunteer who has helped make this a success. It's made a real difference to the lives of local people who receive the devastating news of a cancer diagnosis. We shall miss them, but fully understand the decision to close the committee and wish every member all the very best," she said. A legend of local football has been hailed for his commitment to the sport after his death, aged 73. Patrick Murphy, better known as Paddy, who had a 22-year stint as manager of Blofield United's first team, died on Sunday after a battle with motor neurone disease. Mr. Murphy's contributions to grassroots football were recognised in March when he was presented with an FA 50-year service award by the Football Association. He was involved with Blofield United since he was 14 years old when he started playing for Brundle Miners. In his playing days, he also laced his boots for clubs including Galston, Acle Rangers and Lingwood Caverners. He became Blofield United's first team manager in 1987, and during his 22 years in charge, he led the club to 7 trophies, as well as going unbeaten throughout the 2004-05 season. In a statement released by the club on Tuesday, a club spokesman said, "Paddy sadly passed away at the Norfolk Norwich Hospital, surrounded by his close friends and family, after a brave and courageous 2-year battle against motor neurone disease. All at the club send their deepest love and sincerest condolences to his wife Jenny and the rest of the Murphy family. His record as first team manager will probably remain unsurpassed." A 20-year spell saw him turn a small village club into one of the most feared sides within local football, and his record speaks for itself, with 5 Sterry Cup triumphs alongside 3 Mummery Cup wins and 2 Norfolk Senior Cup semi-final appearances, his one regret being that he could not get a team to the final. Even in his final years, while fighting against this debilitating disease, he rarely missed a first team game and always had a smile on his face. The statement continued, "There simply won't be another one like him. He'll be terribly missed by everyone within the club and throughout the local football world." The club, whose first team play in the Anglian Combination Premier Division, also stressed that Saturday's home game against UEA will go ahead, with a special match day programme in tribute to Mr. Murphy. Both the first and reserve team players will also be wearing black armbands. As we're at that time of year that seems to signal that autumn is really here, the turning back of the clocks and the twin celebrations of Halloween and Bonfire Night, I found a couple of pieces connected with these events. The first concerns a very early but deadly kind of trick or treat, and the second, from historian Dan Snow, gives us the facts of the notorious gunpowder plot. A handful of sweets is as synonymous with Halloween as a spooky costume or a ghoulish pumpkin. But on the 31st of October 1858, this normally harmless treat killed several children, causing panic across Bradford and a rapidly rising death toll. This is the story of how a mix-up at a pharmacy, rooted in trying to save a few pennies on sugar, rocked Victorian Britain and changed UK laws. When William Hardacre shut up shop for the day, he no doubt congratulated himself on a successful day's trade. The market stall holder, known to many as Humbug Billy, had not only sold 5 pounds of peppermint lozenges to the people of Bradford that day, he'd got them at a knockdown price to begin with. When he collected the sweets from the wholesaler, he noticed they were darker than usual, so he haggled with confectioner Joseph Neal and saved 0.5 per pound. Hardacre's failure to question the quality would be a costly mistake, and by nightfall the next day, several of his customers were dead. Initially, the doctor who saw 9-year-old Elijah Wright in the early hours of Halloween 1858 thought the boy had died from cholera. Surgeon John Roberts thought the symptoms of vomiting and convulsions were consistent with the disease which had been rife in England. An hour later, Joseph Scott's father left their home in Railroad Street to fetch a doctor for his 14-year-old son who was suddenly violently ill. By the time he returned, it was too late. Both, it later transpired, had bought sweets from Humbug Billy the day before, but the connection had not yet been made. It was Dr. John Henry Bell who suspected the sweets when he arrived at Jowett Street at about 3 p.m. Orlando Burren, aged 5, and his 3-year-old brother John Henry were lying dead before him. Their father had been ill that morning and 2 others in the house were also sick. All of them had eaten the sweets. So the doctor sent some to chemist Felix Marsh Rimmington to be tested. As the day wore on, reports began pouring in from all over the district that people were ill and dying. Having learned about the sweets from the Burrens, the police went to Hardacre's home and learned he was not only sick in bed from eating his tainted wares, but he'd sold about 1,000 sweets the day before. The police were horrified to discover there were so many sweets in circulation, says Dr. Lauren Paget, Assistant Curator of Collections at Bradford District Museums and Galleries. At this point, she goes on to say, it was getting late into Sunday evening, so they went out into the streets ringing bells to get people's attention and bellowing warnings. They were going from pub to pub telling people, don't eat the sweets, they're poison. Warning notices were swiftly printed and put up in public places. A list of those that were dead or dangerously ill was published in the Bradford Observer, and by November the 4th, the toll had reached 18, with the youngest aged just 17 months. The newspaper described the growing list of casualties as the most dreadful calamity that perhaps ever befell this district, spreading suffering, mourning and woe. Detectives were quick to piece together how the sweets had been spiked. They had followed the trail from Hardacre to Neil, who thought he'd replaced some of the costly sugar in the sweets with plaster of Paris. It was common practice in the 19th century to use the powder, often known as daft, in place of expensive ingredients, and it could be bought cheaply from pharmacies. What Neil didn't know was that on the day he sent his colleague to collect the daft, druggist Charles Hodgson was sick and had simply told his untrained apprentice, William Goddard, where to find it. Unfortunately, there were 2 unmarked casks of white powder in the room, one containing the innocuous daft, the other poisonous arsenic. Goddard went to a barrel he assumed contained plaster of Paris and collected 12 pounds of it, gave it to the young lad who took it back to the confectioners, where another employee began to mix it in and make the lozenges, says Dr. Paget. He himself became really unwell from being exposed to the arsenic, but rather than alarm bells going off, he carried on making them. The calamitous series of events continued when Humbug Billy picked up his order and simply negotiated a discounted rate on the odd-looking sweets before selling them on his stall at Green Market. When chemist Rimmington analysed them, he told the inquest he'd found arsenic in great abundance, in sufficient quantity to destroy life. In fact, in one lozenge alone, he found 16 grains of arsenic, 4 times the amount considered a poisonous dose and enough to kill someone several times over. This was a phenomenal amount of arsenic, says sweet and confectionery historian Alex Hutchinson. To us as 21st century consumers, it seems mad that this astonishingly poisonous stuff was odourless, didn't taste of anything, and that it could be stored in an unmarked barrel next to something else that wasn't labelled and could be just handed over to the counter to anyone. The poisoning sparked a public outcry, and newspapers all over the country covered the case in depth. Artist John Leech perhaps became as well known for his drawing in the Punch magazine of a skeleton pounding sugar in a sweet shop as he was for illustrating the first edition of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. But the suffering was felt most in Bradford, now a city, but then a town of 50,000 people, where for a brief period it was as dreadful as if the plague had smitten us, wrote the Bradford Observer. Officially, 20 people, many of them children, died, and a further 200 people were seriously ill. But Dr. Paget suspects the numbers were probably far higher, because the sweets were also found in Leeds and as far away as Bolton. It had been quite harrowing for everyone, she says. Bradford was very close-knit, so when something happened in the community, everyone was affected by it, which is what happened in this case. It's likely people knew someone who'd been affected. Ultimately, the Bradford poisonings highlighted the importance of ensuring the safety of medicines and consumer products, according to the Royal Pharmaceutical Society. It helped usher in the Pharmacy Act of 1868, which not only limited the sale of poisons and dangerous drugs to qualified pharmacists and druggists, but established a regulatory framework for the sale of poisons that to this day requires drugs to be appropriately labelled. Had it been in force a decade earlier, it might have prevented Goddard from both picking the wrong barrel and selling the powder. But it wouldn't have solved the broader issue of adulterated foods. The industry needed regulation and reform. Alex Hutchinson continues, up until 1820, most of us were living in villages or small towns where we knew the people producing our food. But by the Industrial Revolution, manufacturers were making things in large quantities and adding substances to dilute the food, either to preserve its shelf life, make it look nicer, or make it cheaper. And that was the problem in Bradford. A law preventing unadvertised adulteration was eventually passed in 1875 in the form of the Sale of Food and Drugs Act. But warnings could have been heeded much earlier, says Alex Hutchinson. In 1820, chemist Frederick Ackham wrote in his book Death in the Pot that common foods like milk, flour, beer and sweets were routinely tampered with. His book was a huge bestseller. He warned consumers to be on their guard, and they started to get wise to the fact that there were adulterants in their food. But there just wasn't the legislation to protect people, and Bradford was the final straw. Though laws were put in place to prevent a tragedy like Bradford happening again, it's perhaps shocking to learn no one faced any criminal charges. Humbug Billy was never arrested, but was left paralysed from the effects of eating his contaminated sweets. Neil, Goddard and Hodgson were all arrested for manslaughter, and the inquest concluded the latter was guilty, although it conceded that, quote, arsenic had been sold accidentally and mixed under the supposition that it was daft. The York Assizes didn't reach the same judgment, and all three were eventually acquitted in December 1858. The grand jury dismissed indictments against Neil and Goddard, and, according to the Bradford Observer, the judge himself stopped the prosecution against Hodgson. No other result was to be anticipated, the court report read. The only really criminal thing in the whole affair was what the law could not touch, the practice of adulteration and the supply of daft for that purpose. If the calamity teach this lesson, it will not have been useless. In the end, the chain of events that led to the Bradford poisonings was sheer incompetence. But as a Halloween story, it's a very gruesome one. Now, moving on to the 5th of November. The letter was anonymous, but it was unambiguous. It reads, I would advise you, as you tend to your life, to devise some excuse to shift your attendance at this Parliament, the mysterious author beseeched, for they shall receive a terrible blow this Parliament. As soon as Baron Monteagle received this mysterious warning, he showed it to the Secretary of State, who in turn took it to the King. James I ordered a thorough search of the Palace of Westminster, and in the early hours of this morning, in 1605, 36 barrels of gunpowder were found. It was enough to obliterate the ruling class of England when it gathered for the opening of Parliament later that day. Standing over the barrels was a man carrying a lantern, dressed in a cloak and hat, his pockets stuffed with slow match. His name was Guy Fawkes. The gunpowder plot was masterminded by Robert Catesby, a tall, athletic, handsome Catholic from an ancient family who dreamed of returning the English people to the Roman Church. His plan was to kill king, lords, bishop and commoners at the opening of Parliament, kidnap James's daughter, Princess Elizabeth, and install her on the throne as a puppet. He had recruited a small group, including Fawkes, an English-born Catholic who had fought for the Spanish against the Protestant Dutch rebels. The conspirators easily found an empty, unused undercroft beneath the House of Lords in the labyrinthine cellars of the Palace of Westminster. Barrels of gunpowder were smuggled in and covered with a layer of firewood and coal. And it was here that Fawkes was found and arrested. 2 days later, James personally authorised torture. After 24 hours at the hands of the torturers of the Tower, Fawkes confessed and gave the names of the fellow conspirators. And they were captured after a shootout at Holbeach House in Staffordshire. It was one of history's most audacious terrorist plots, and the anniversary became an annual jingoistic celebration of Protestantism and English exceptionalism, the start of a tradition of bonfires, fireworks and revelry that endures to this day.
The straitjacket of true love's fine, bang bang. If you're Houdini in your spare time, bang bang. Lord Nell and Lady Hamilton, they fought for love. When he come home from the war, he give a what for love. The mighty fall when love has called. Vampire friends desire to lust, bang bang. They fall on necks, then fall in love, pang, pang. The Marquis de Sade was happy with a stroke of love. Sherlock Holmes alone preferred a little toke of love. Bang, bang, the mighty fall. Bang, bang, when love is called. Bang, bang, the mighty fall. Tony and Cleo struck out for the Frio down Egypt's way. But Caesar had squeezed her in Rome on his quilt for a day. Hey, hey. Now Antony got really angry. But old Caesar's hanky-panky. She told him she would use him, and boy did she abuse him. Fall in love and blew him away. Mighty fall, bang bang, when love is called. Bang bang, the mighty fall, bang bang. Na 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 na. And Sam and Delilah, they both, we should file under fool. When the temples start to crumble, Sammy for his comb did fumble. Life was in a ruin. She loved Johnny Fruin. Fall in love and blew him away. Bang, bang, when love has called. Bang, bang, the mighty fall. Bang, bang, when love has called. Bang, bang.
Interesting stuff there. Plus, the second Bang song from 1979, courtesy of B.A. Robertson. Right, it's time to get you completely up to date with the rest of this week's local news.
The Good Hotel Awards have announced their 2024 winners, with two of Norfolk's best making it onto the list. Yeah, that really does say 2024 there. The first award winner is the picturesque Congham Hall Hotel and Spa in West Norfolk. The Georgian Manor House is set in the picturesque Norfolk countryside, just a stone's throw away from Sandringham House. A spokesperson from the hotel said they were delighted about winning the award. "We're especially happy about the focus on the gardens, with all the hard work of the team of four paying off. The gardens, while offering a great backdrop for guests, also provide fresh and seasonal produce for use in their kitchen." Nearer to home, the second winner was the Potter's Resort in Hopton-on-Sea. The all-inclusive resort, as we know, is nestled on the coast. Established in 1920 at Hemsby and moving to the clifftop at Hopton in 1924 as a traditional holiday camp, the resort has grown and improved over the years, including adding a site in Essex, and it now offers a huge variety of five-star accommodation types, including bungalows that stretch down to the sea. The resort has also a wide range of sports, activities and entertainments on offer, leading them to receive the Good Hotels Awards Gold Seal. An investigation into the death of a man whose torso washed up on a Norfolk beach has concluded that third-party involvement cannot be ruled out. The partial remains of Colin Wood, 53, were found near Great Yarmouth Wellington Pier by a sea angler out fishing late at night. Details of the mysterious case emerged at an inquest into Mr. Wood's death yesterday, and the inquest was unable to establish a cause. The hearing was told that a fisherman made the grim discovery at around 12:30 a.m. on May the 4th last year. He called the police around an hour later after realising that the lump of flesh he had discovered on the shoreline might be human remains and not a fish or other marine life. Officers recovered the item and carried out a search of the area but found nothing else of interest. An investigation was launched involving DNA tests of the remains, part of the abdomen, which identified them as belonging to Mr. Woods, and police then probed his background. At the inquest, a statement from a Home Office forensic pathologist was read by Assistant Coroner Christopher Leach. He said, "We briefly heard evidence from the forensic pathologist who had been instructed to carry out a post-mortem examination of what we now know to be Colin's remains. We know that the pathologist could not rule out third-party involvement in this case. The pathologist confirmed that a human could not live without the remains that had been found on the beach. But the pathologist, given the limited nature of the human remains that had been found, was unable to ascertain a medical cause of death. The pathologist indicated there may be a number of explanations for the death." The inquest was told Mr. Wood, who lived in Yarmouth, had a chaotic life, and it previously emerged that he'd been released from jail weeks before his remains were found. He had served half of a 26-week sentence after being convicted of a series of offences, including assaulting an emergency worker, criminal damage, and breaching an antisocial behaviour order which banned him from an area of Bradwell. Police established that the last confirmed sighting of Mr. Wood was on April 30, 2022, when he was shopping at St. Nicholas Convenience Store in Yarmouth. Background evidence heard in the court revealed that Mr. Wood had been seen and discharged from mental health services on several occasions. He had also been diagnosed with a personality disorder and had struggled with mental ill health following the death of his sister many years previously. He had gone to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre on April the 26th, seeking a place of safety as he felt he was at risk to himself. But a review by the Forces Crisis Team said they were unable to complete an assessment as Mr. Wood's primary focus had been on his housing situation. He was directed to other services for help and was given a lift back to the place he was staying. The next day, he engaged with mental health services again at the James Paget Hospital in Goulston. Again, he was focused on and clearly distressed by the prospect of being homeless and left the hospital before an assessment could be completed. Referring to statements read out in court, Mr. Leach said, "Colin did not present at that time as acutely mentally unwell, nor did he present with suicidal ideation or intent." Norfolk Constabulary conducted a detailed investigation into Mr. Wood's disappearance and death. Included in it was a report from the Waves Group, which investigates marine casualties and incidents. Its report stated that the area Mr. Wood's body likely entered the water was found to be a busy shipping area with movement of 50 to 100 vessels in any 24-hour period. Damage found on his remains could have been due to being struck by the propellers of a medium or large-sized vessel or by a vessel's hull at speed. As a result, police said there was no evidence of any third-party involvement in Mr. Wood's death, and the report concluded that he died of his own actions, with his body being damaged in the water or prior to entering it. The medical cause of death was given as unascertained. A woman was horrified to find debris, including plastic wiring from a firework display, strewn all over a local beach. Nick Clifford, age 49, was walking along the beach at North Deans in Yarmouth on Sunday morning, October the 29th, when she and a friend found a litter which included small cardboard tubes and plastic wiring. "My friend and I had a bag each, but there was so much of the stuff we could not pick it all up," she said. "We were surprised because so much of the innards of the fireworks are made of heavy-duty plastic." On Saturday night, October the 28th, Haven Seashore Park in North Deans organised a firework display. Although it cannot be confirmed where the debris originated from, a spokesperson for Haven said, "Every year Haven Seashore Park puts on a firework display for its guests. This year, as we have done previously, we worked with Great Yarmouth Borough Council and our firework provider to ensure a full and thorough clean-up operation was carried out the day after the event." Miss Clifford, who volunteers with the Marine Conservation Charity, the Captain Paul Watson Foundation UK, said it seemed ironic later that day watching the new Planet Earth 3 documentary, which was about plastic in the oceans. "And just for human entertainment, for a few bangs and flashes, a few oohs and ahs, and this is what we're doing," she said. "We chuck litter in the air and think it's going to disappear in the ether. No, it comes down again." A spokesperson for the Borough Council said, "The council has received no reports about debris from firework displays. However, our rangers team will be carrying out checks on Great Yarmouth Beach and will make arrangements for any cleansing that is required." Two members of a County Lines gang, described as its muscle and salesman, have been jailed for their role in supplying cocaine in Great Yarmouth. Chase Staff, 33, and Kyle Thomas, 27, were both senior figures in the local trafficking of cocaine. Norwich Crown Court heard Staff was responsible for running the operation and providing the muscle, while Thomas had a, quote, significant role as salesman. The gang used two phone lines to supply 1,384.2 grams and 1,575.95 grams of Class A drugs onto the streets of Great Yarmouth between January 2022 and May this year. On Wednesday, Staff from Ormsby Lane, Filby, was jailed for 5 years after previously admitting being concerned in the supply of cocaine. Richard White, prosecuting, said police first started to unravel the network after two youths were arrested in connection with cocaine dealing in the town in February 2022. The arrests sparked further investigations to identify others who might be involved in the operation, and a few days later, one of the gang was spotted acting suspiciously by officers. He ran away, but dropped a mobile phone which gave detectives further leads in the case. Mr. White said they were able to interrogate the phone and uncover further drugs messages. In July last year, hundreds more messages were found after a phone belonging to a 17-year-old, who cannot be named but who was involved in the operation, was discovered following an arrest. The following month, two gang members were stopped in a car in Yarmouth with £18,000 of cash seized. Mr. White said the amount demonstrated the scale of the operation. Further arrests followed, including that of Staff on May the 30th this year. When he was detained, officers also seized mobile phones and cash, including £1,260, in a pram. Other gang members were sentenced on Wednesday, after admitting being concerned in the supply of drugs. Sean Murray, 29, from Elder Green, Goulston, and Robin Beals, 27, from Peter Close, Caistron-on-Sea. They both received two-year sentences, suspended for 2 years. In addition, one 17-year-old received a six-month youth referral order, while the other youth, who also admitted possession with intent to supply cannabis, was given a 12-month youth referral order. Sentencing the gang, recorder John Hardy said, "All of you know the effect that this drug can have on other people. Some of you have yourselves experienced addiction to this drug and the misery it can cause, but notwithstanding that, you at various levels cooperated in this enterprise." Another man accused of being in the gang failed to attend court, and a warrant has been issued for his arrest. Michael Clare, in mitigation for staff, accepted his client was the muscle in the operation, but insisted he has not, quote, made a significant financial advantage, and he was paying off a debt. He said his muscle was important, but to say he ran the operation was incorrect. Stephen Spence, mitigating for Thomas, said his client had been very frank in stating he knew what he was doing was wrong, but the problem is not knowing when to say no. He said Thomas was a salesman who was dealing drugs and collecting money in the operation, not to feed an addiction, but he was trying to improve himself financially. John Morgans, for Beals, said the defendant had no previous convictions, became addicted to Class A drugs in his adult life, and was solely involved in the supply of drugs to which he was addicted to maintain his own supply. He said Beals was criminally inexperienced and an amateur who seemed to be using more drugs than he was supplying. Mr. Morgans, who also represented a 17-year-old who cannot be identified, said he was there because he got himself involved in this enterprise, but had got no previous convictions. Ian James, for a 17-year-old youth who also cannot be identified, said the teen is now 17 but was just 16 at the time of the offending. Daniel O'Donovan, for Murray, said his involvement was short-lived, with him acting as a runner and no more than that.
Well, that's it for this week's recording, which is copyright 2023 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. If you need to contact us, you can do so via our website at grapevinegy.org or telephone us on 07947 946 493, where you can access our regularly checked answering service. Next week, your newsreader will be Desney, so we look forward to welcoming you then for much more of your local news. In the meantime, from all at Grapevine, stay safe and well, and bye for now.